Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and it's Election Day, finally, and we will be delivering a parting shot to the nasty political ads that will go into hibernation until the Iowa caucuses in early 2016. We'll also spell out the results tomorrow, but today we will look ahead at American politics through the lens of Texas, a state undergoing robust change.
Battleground Texas was founded, in fact, by people who are not from Texas, but are operatives who worked for the president in 2008 and 2012 very successfully to turn out huge numbers of the vote. And that's why this has been a strategic battle between the two major parties. And that's why the results will belie the numbers.
More on Texas from Richard Parker, author of The Lone Star Nation, coming up. We'll hear a little of the music of Bach to kick off the month of November, accompanied by your thoughts on what might be a rational political strategy for bringing this nation together. By the way, you can find your own polling place at thetakeaway.org, courtesy of the Voting Info Project. But we begin with a walk across America, 300 miles of it anyway. The last patrol, four men and a dog trying to come home from the addictive violence of war.
All of us had been in combat. All of us had lost people. None of us were going to go back to war. And I took him on this 300-plus mile journey along the railroad lines, partly to sort of meet America again and partly to talk about why war is so hard to unhook from.
After nearly 20 years covering war, his 2010 Afghanistan movie Restrepo was nominated for an Academy Award. Journalist and documentarian Sebastian Junger says he's done filing from the battlefield. His latest movie, The Last Patrol, was suggested by his longtime friend and collaborator, Tim Hetherington.
He was, as you know, he was tragically killed in Libya on a trip I was supposed to be on with him, and I couldn't at the last minute. I couldn't go, and then he was killed. And I was going to do this journey with Tim, and
He even suggested it.
Well, I thought of it, yeah. And he was like, okay, say that again into the camera. And years later, after he died, I found that bit of footage on the hard drive where he's saying, okay, tell me your idea again, right? And so I tell my – we're on an Amtrak train, and I'm looking out the window. I'm like, we could walk along this whole damn thing. And we could sleep outside, you know, et cetera. And I describe my idea for the trip, and he's totally psyched about it. And then he gets himself killed. And it was tragic. It tore my life apart for a while.
That life of Sebastian's is beginning to settle down, and this final film of a trilogy is a bit like the movie Deliverance or Kerouac's On the Road. But for veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan, there's nothing quite like it.
A lot of soldiers really miss combat. They really miss the war, which is confusing to them and to their spouses and to everybody else, you know. It feels so wrong to miss something so bad, right? But what they're really missing is human closeness.
Right.
I mean, they're in combat in a group of 20, 30 men in a bunker, whatever. Like, that combat experience is very intimate, actually, and you're very connected in a human way to other people. Yeah. And then they come back to this wide-open, fragmented, alienating society, and frankly, it's pretty scary. In an odd way, it's more frightening than combat. So the value that this film has, I think, is it shows four men who are recreating that close bond, except they're not getting shot at. They're back home. We're back home. I mean, okay, we're walking on railroad lines. We're doing something weird, but it is
in
the United States.
It's not so weird. It's America.
It's America.
It is America, yeah. And it's not the America of the supermarkets where there's a million options for buying cereal and the overstimulated sense that so many other films give when soldiers come back home and they just kind of, you know, lose it. This is a very relaxed sense of comfort in this journey.
Yeah, we didn't have tents, right? We slept under bridges and in abandoned buildings, and we bathed in rivers and cooked dinner over twig fires in the woods, and it was all illegal, so we had to avoid the police. We made ourselves marginal, right? And you know, at the end of the day, what we needed a safe place to sleep where we would have cover from the rain, where no one would see us, and access to water. Very elemental human concerns. When soldiers come back, they feel socially marginal because their experience has changed them a lot. What I did is I made us literally physically marginal, and in that process, we bonded together very, very well, and that was absolutely therapeutic for all of us.
And what you see around you is everything in America.
That's right. I mean, the cool thing about railroad is it goes straight through the middle of everything. It goes right through the ghettos of Baltimore, right through the rich suburbs of Philadelphia, right? The industry and farms and wilderness. I mean, it just skewers everything. You see America from the inside out. And, you know, these areas going through the cities, obviously we're not on the railroad line. It's sort of fenced off. So then we're on surface streets. And one of the things we did, I started out asking people, how's the country doing? What's going on? How do you think we're doing? And actually, that wasn't a very good question, because people, what they would do is they would complain about where we're at, legitimately, I think, but they would complain with sound bites they'd heard on the media. You know, we're turning into a socialist country, or we have to get closer to God. You know, it's like, it's completely useless analysis for the complex situation we're in, right? So I got tired of those questions, so I started doing is saying, what's the best thing about this country? And it was really interesting. The poorer the community, I mean, we walked through some hardcore ghettos in Baltimore, and in the really poor communities, African-American communities, people would say, it's a free country. That's the best thing about America, is that we're free. In the wealthy communities, they didn't say that. They said, America is the land of opportunity. And I just had this thought, like, we're in a tough place right now, this country is. And what we have to do is flip those so that rich people actually truly get it, how lucky they are to be free, to live in a free country. They don't even think of it, right? It doesn't even occur to them. And poor people, we have to get this country to a place where poor people actually think it's a land of opportunity. And until we flip that, we're going to be in trouble.
You know, one of the things that I loved is how you get into some details about coming home from war.
I've never looked for a job.
You've never looked for a job?
Ever. And then buying clothes. Yeah. I think I'll just wear the same thing every day.
Yeah.
But I would say that I won't miss, like, the Army.
Yeah.
In a big... It's been good. They've given me every single thing I have. But I won't miss it. The institution.
Yeah, Dave Rolls, one of the two soldiers, vets, he went into the service at 17 or 18. He's never applied for a job, and he's never bought clothes. He just wears the same thing all the time, except, as he said, once a week when he goes to church, and his wife probably buys him those clothes, you know. And these guys are coming. You know, the last time they were civilians, they were teenagers, and now Dave's 40. It's tough. It really is tough.
Guillermo describes you at one point in this movie, and I want to play that clip for you.
Sebastian, for me, is the lost of the group. He's lost, trying to find himself, trying to follow directions from Dave because you're lost.
We're stringing the tarp up right here, slope that way.
Trying to follow directions from me in a way when talking about women, because you're lost. Like the lost kid who is the oldest in the family, who tried to take care of the other kids.
Did you edit that?
I was part of the decision to put that in, yeah. I mean, I had an editor, but yeah, that was my decision.
What did it feel like to hear that from him?
I loved it, actually. I've sort of structured my life around trying to be good at things. And it was so great to have someone come in and say, but you're also lost. And I was like, you know, I had gone through a very painful period in my life. Tim had died. My dad had just died right before we left on this trip. My personal life was, you know, in a very, very tricky place. I was suffering significant consequences from the combat. I was a complete mess. And I'm good now. But, you know, half of us in that, there are four of us, half of us, our marriages were breaking up. All of us had some version of PTSD.
Alcoholism comes up.
Alcoholism, yeah. And half of us had just lost our fathers. We were a wounded group in a lot of ways.
Are you lost now?
No, I feel good. I feel good, yeah. A lot of things changed in my life. But, you know, one of them was like this incredible year-long experience out there with these guys that was I actually struggled to really articulate why it helped so much, but it was a very, very good thing for us.
After this, I gather riding the Acela must be pretty boring.
I'm worried they're going to recognize me and keep me from getting on the train.
There you go. Always undercover.
That's right.
Always behind enemy lines. Sebastian Younger, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sebastian Junger is a journalist, co-director of the award-winning documentary Restrepo, and the director of this latest documentary film, The Last Patrol. Oh, man. That causes a hitch in the heart. Before car talk, auto mechanics, we can all agree on this, we're not, shall we say, the most admired folks in America. And today we note the passing of Tom Magliazzi. Clack has lost his click. Don't Drive Like My Brother brings a tear to the eye today. The duo who made mechanics happy heroes and made it okay to laugh at your own jokes live on in radio memories.
This guy, you'd have to say, was definitely out there. I mean, that would be a good way to describe him, would you say?
Oh, yeah, he was out there, all right. And it took us a while, but we eventually caught on.
Tom and his brother Ray were a local public radio idea dreamed up in Boston, who the audience only had to hear once before falling completely in love. They went national almost immediately, changing call-in radio forever, making callers actual guests, and making show business out of head gaskets, fuel pumps, and timing chains. And you loved it all.
I just wanted to send my condolences to all of us who grew up with Car Talk. Click and Clack were more than entertainment, and it was an American institution.
David from Tacoma Park, Maryland. I learned so much from Click and Clack. I always had a great laugh on the weekend.
My name's Dave Kearsley, and I've been listening to Car Talk for a long time. My favorite memory of Tom is his story about being on the Army firing range and pretending to shoot at the targets by saying bang, 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 and the drill instructor coming up behind him and saying, Private Magliozzi, what are you doing? Really going to miss those guys.
That's a good one. I remember listening to one of the puzzlers, one of you actually shared this on our website, thetakeaway.org, which involved the drive shaft falling off of a car. I knew the answer to the puzzler right away because it had happened to my truck. I learned so much from Click and Clack and always had a great laugh on the weekends. You know, and it wasn't just cars. It was those lawyers, Dewey, Cheatham, and Howe, right? There was the bowling coach, me knock him down, head of front desk security, Constance Noring, Tom. Thank you for everything you did for all of us. By the way, the fleet manager, Lisa Carr. Drivers, non-drivers, public radio listeners, non-public radio listeners, they were all fans, folks who enjoyed the sound of laughter and banjo from everyone at The Takeaway. Here's to Tom Magliazzi and Car Talk. Do we really need an excuse to talk to our good friend Jeff Spurgeon from WQXR, our sister station here at WNYC? What a great idea you've had.
It's a month-long festival called Bachstock, 30 Days of Peace and Music. Everybody needs a gimmick. We found a great one, but a great guy to do it with, because Bach just goes on and on and on.
You could fill 10 months of Bach.
It's really true.
Why do you love this?
This is great music because it somehow manages to reach deep inside us, but has stuff that satisfies the intellect, too. And it also is just pretty. If you put it on, it's pretty. So it's full-service music. Nothing else like it.
Deep structure. I love the puzzles that are in the fugues, the orchestral suites that have weird, strange modulations.
And what Bach apparently was able to do was he thought in four or five or six different lines at once. He didn't write down one line and then figure out the harmony. It just sort of all came out of this genius brain of his.
When he was writing, half the time he was improvising the whole thing simultaneously.
And he was busy at home making children,
yes,
too.
Exactly,
about a full life.
All right, let's hear another one.
All right, let's tackle an unaccompanied cello sonata. This is just one of the most famous pieces of Bach there is. It's just one line, but we hear all the harmony in it. We don't mean to.
Because he wrote it for a space.
That's a, that's a great way to put it.
Yeah, he wrote it for a space so the echo makes the chord so you hear the whole thing.
Yeah, and it's just beautiful. And it sings, all of this stuff is happening at one time, but what you feel is just the warmth of this great big fat cello sound.
Who is that playing?
It's Yo-Yo Ma. Not so bad.
And of course, Rostropovich did this.
And Casals, who found the things and made them popular, and that recording's still in print, too. People can't get enough of these works.
So amazing.
A couple of things are happening here.
Yeah.
One, this is a lullaby, but it's about death, and Bach knew about that. He had 20 children. Only 10 of them survived to adulthood. So if you're in grief or mourning, Bach can comfort you because he's been there. The other thing that's happening here, as Thomas Kvasthoff sings, is the other great thing I think about Bach, which is that most of it is a dance. So there's a dance in almost every piece of Bach, and if you play it right, it's going to dance.
Well, so many of her are literally dance suites.
Absolutely, absolutely. And he experimented with dance forms all the time.
Yeah.
But Bach almost always is swinging one way or another. Take, for instance, the Brandenburg Concertos, which are, again, this failed resume that he sent off to a minor prince in Berlin who never answered him. And these things lay unused for five or six generations. And then somebody picked them up. But I love the conversation that the instruments have with each other. And they're also always dancing, which you don't think of when you think of German Lutherans from the 18th century.
Right.
But there they are, dancing all the time.
They had to get it out somewhere.
I think
so. So we're going to be doing a show together, right?
Yeah. The Academy of Ancient Music is bringing their new performance of the four Bach orchestral suites to Carnegie Hall. And you and I will be there to present it on the radio.
And we didn't even have to practice.
That's the sweet part about this job.
Jeff Spurgeon from our sister station WQXR and I will be at Carnegie Hall on Friday celebrating Bach this entire month. What a great idea.
Thanks, John.
From Bach to something quite different. In January, President Obama told The New Yorker's David Remnick that if he had a son, he would not let him play pro football. Well, I mean, is that terribly controversial? But those comments, along with the president calling on the Redskins to change their name, have riled up Rush Limbaugh, the perennially riled up, and Mark Levin, the perennially riled up, and also Glenn Beck, who all see pro football as a red state sport in need of defending from a Democratic president. But a look at the numbers shows concern among college-educated liberals regarding the dangers of playing football. The Upshot, a New York Times political and policy website, found that the number of boys playing football in high school has declined 15% in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And those are two states President Obama won in the last two elections. David Lanhart is editor of The Upshot and joins us from right here in New York. Is there a divide here in America, or is this Limbaughian showbiz?
There is a divide. Rush is right, at least about some aspect of this. There isn't a divide about watching football. Blue America and Red America are both watching football in enormous numbers. There's no sign that the popularity of the game as a form of entertainment is shrinking. But it's clear that Blue America, and particularly college-educated Blue America, in many of the big metropolitan areas across the country, is getting much less comfortable with the idea of letting their kids play. So you mentioned Minnesota and Wisconsin. High school participation in football is also falling in California, in New York, in Maryland, in Massachusetts. And when you line up all the states and look at them, you see a pretty clear pattern. High school participation in football is falling more in blue states than in red states.
Now, David, you sound very reasonable. You don't sound even remotely like Glenn Beck, who said that the president is now officially a girl for what he told David Remnick. But are you suggesting that Republicans are pro-concussion?
I am not. I think it's interesting to see if you we asked the RAND Corporation to do a poll on this, and what they found is that there's only one group that is notably less comfortable, and it's Obama voters, which is to say Democratic voters.
Right.
With college degrees. Democratic voters without college degrees look a lot like Republican voters with or without college degrees in terms of their level of comfort with football, which is less than with other sports, but a lot more than liberal eggheads, if you will. And I think there's sort of a classic pattern here. There are a lot of public safety issues, whether it's smoking, whether it's seatbelts, that start in a certain corner of society, a more educated, more liberal corner of society. And if the science continues to show that this is a real public health issue, it goes mainstream. If the science doesn't, I would argue genetically modified foods are probably an example of that. They don't seem that dangerous. It probably won't go mainstream.
Is it possible you're extracting a tiny slice of the stat here and that, in fact, the trend is much broader in the sense that squash is a Democratic sport for liberals and that playing the horses is Republican and that you need to sort of broaden it out to all sports to take a look at more lifestyle questions here rather than simply the public health issue?
I think there are two reasons why we think this is real. One is that RAND didn't just ask about football in its poll. It asked about a series of sports. And football was the only one in which politics helped predict people's attitudes. People are also less comfortable letting their sons play hockey than, say, track and field, or letting their daughters play hockey than other sports, although there are probably a few things going on there. But politics doesn't predict the difference. So that's one thing. The second thing is these high school participation numbers, these aren't just one poll with 1,000 respondents. These are decisions made by millions of families across the country, and they represent change. We're seeing a change in which more liberal, more educated areas are saying, we don't want our sons playing football, even if we still watch it on Saturdays and Sundays.
David, I've never asked you this before. Are you a Jets fan or a Giants fan?
Oh, well, I'm a Patriots fan.
Ooh.
Despite being a New Yorker, I spent 6 years from ages 2 to 8 in Boston, and those are the formative years when it comes to sports. So
you're going to get some mail, bud.
I know. I have my whole life.
David Leonard, editor of The Upshot, joins us from New York. Patriots fan, it turns out. Thanks, David.
Thanks, John.
Election Day in Texas may not have any big cliffhangers, but the state is proving to be the laboratory of 21st century American politics. The Lone Star State is growing in population. Its economy is growing. Its diversity is growing. It will soon be a majority Hispanic state with the economic power of a Brazil. But according to the National Education Association, it spends less on education per pupil than any other state apart from Arizona and Nevada. The state of vast population, vast geography, and vast contradictions is the subject of Richard Parker's new book, Lone Star Nation, which could be a snapshot of the 2016 election. Richard Parker joins us from our friends at KUT in Austin. Richard, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, John.
So my big question is, how come Texas is so much like the future of America, but the rhetoric in Texas is so much like the past?
That's a great question. I think we are seeing changes in Texas that are only now kind of manifesting themselves. One of the biggest is population growth. People are moving to Texas from all points on the American map. Another is the fact that Hispanics will be the largest ethnic group in Texas, not in the future, but today. These things are sort of the tip of the iceberg of a much broader social trend with political impacts, and we're only seeing that tip above the water right now.
And part of that social change is something you describe very persuasively in people from Rust Belt states coming down to Texas to take advantage of the extraordinary economic growth, which says a lot about where Texas is going to be in the next 20 years. But they're using Texas's conservatism to make a play for a high profile. And one example of that is how Ted Nugent has become a spokesman for the governor's race, the Republican in the governor's race against Wendy Davis, who is the woman Democrat who is getting all kinds of pushback in her very, very difficult race.
No, that's correct. In fact, if you look kind of carefully at the landscape of who's who in Texas politics today, a great many of the sort of most conservative figures and even elected officials in Congress in particular are actually people who were part of that migration from the Midwest. They are not native Texans by any stretch of the imagination.
Why does Wendy Davis get so much virulent political rhetoric against her when you've got Ann Richards, who's already been a woman governor in the state of Texas and is actually revered as a Democrat?
I think that's a great question, because as I've watched the campaign unfold, Davis has been the target of misogynistic, sexist comments, just absolute tirades. Much of the very conservative media online, whether it's National Review or Red State, if you Google her name every day, as I do with all of the candidates, you will find that the top search results are fairly virulent attacks upon her character, her personality. But they're very virulent in some of their social views. And I think that that comes across quite clearly in Davis's campaign. But I also think there's a second factor. This campaign, this election season in Texas, will turn out to be far more important than the numbers may suggest during the election itself. That is to say, this has been a real strategic battle between a hard right conservative Republican establishment and a Democratic party in Texas that's been virtually absent but assisted significantly by veterans of the Obama campaigns. Battleground Texas was founded, in fact, by people who are not from Texas, but are operatives who worked for the president in 2008 and 2012 very successfully to turn out huge numbers of the vote. And that's why this has been a strategic battle between the two major parties. And that's why the results will belie the numbers.
And, you know, let's note that Wendy Davis has made some mistakes in her campaign. So, you know, it's not all about horrible, vicious attacks on the part of Republicans. But it's interesting that you note that perhaps if there is a long-term strategy for the Democrats thinking about 2016, it's the fact that they've centered their base of operations very, very early in the game in Texas, anticipating that some of these numbers that you're talking about are going to shift in favor of the Democrats. Let's end this conversation with the discussion of the economic growth in Texas, which really is the big story, and that's one that's going to take us all the way to 2050.
Very true. I write that Texas is the California of the 21st century. That is to say, what we're going to see is a population growth that will double the number of people living in Texas from about 27 million today to more than 50 million by the middle of this century. We're also going to see that Texas, which has already survived the first 15 years of this century with a robust economy, will actually account for one-sixth of all the economic activity in the United States. It will displace Germany as, in fact, the sixth largest economy in the world by the middle of this century. The Texas economy will mean the difference between America being the number one economy in the world and China being the number two. If you were to remove the economic activity, the boom in Texas that people talk so much about, it would affect the strategic place of the American economy in the world.
And most of those people in 2050 will probably have never seen an oil rig and probably won't know much about cattle.
That's very true. The Texas economy is diversified now among six different sectors. Energy only comes in fourth. Services is at the top. That ranges from lawyers and accountants to hairdressers and carpenters. So and what we're seeing, too, is that 80% of the population growth in Texas is not evenly scattered across the wide open spaces, but it's concentrated in what's called the Texas Triangle, the area between Dallas-Fort Worth, Austin-San Antonio, and Houston. That's where 8 in 10 people are living in Texas. And in fact, by the middle of this century, 1 in 10 Americans will call Texas home.
Well, if you want to get a good beginning start on the issues and the demographics and the economic issues that are going to drive the 2016 election, you could do a lot worse than reading Richard Parker's book, Lone Star Nation, How Texas Will Transform America. It's a great look ahead at 2016 and beyond. Richard, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. Good to be with you.
Before we go, let's say goodbye to America's Democratic answer to fingernails scraping on a blackboard. After each election day, we can at least count on a break from the nasty, dreadful, well, you know.
Candidate Bev Cranston voted to cut off funding for the elderly. She'd rather let your grandparents starve than give up her luxury helicopter, flying her and her fat cat friends down to spas paid for by Al-Qaeda.
An independent study funded by people who support American coal over rich Middle East oil extortionists ranks Kevin Longworth as the lawmaker most likely to sell your children into slavery.
Andrew Pettibone used taxpayer money to fund his trophy wife's wardrobe while voting against funding for new shoes for veterans.
This election day, say no to Ted McCracken, who once suggested that people infected with Ebola be employed as birthday party clowns.
Elect Bud Parker, or there won't be another election day.
Well, folks, that's the true beauty of election day, isn't it? After today, you won't have to hear an attack ad for at least 10 minutes. And for those of you not totally turned off by attack ads and politics, why don't you write your own and send it to us, huh? At 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also find your own polling place at thetakeaway.org, courtesy of the Voting Info Project, so you have no excuse not to vote today. Keep the calls coming as well. What's your political manifesto? Thinking about Texas as the snapshot of the 2016 election. Be concise in your strategy for the GOP or the Democrats, or if you're an independent, try to come up with a mandate to bring us all together. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Have fun today, folks. We'll talk about all the results tomorrow on the program. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Moo.com, offering business cards with Printfinity, the option for a different image on every card in a pack. More at Moo.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.